Broadcasting live from the Bank 59 studios at the Wisconsin State Fair. It's time for Point Taken. Here's Kristen Bry. And in for Steve Scafidi, here's Todd Albaugh.
I don't think we're at the State Fair today.
I don't care. My name's on TMJ.
There you go. W-TMJ. Absolutely. Well, part of that is correct. So, yes, today you are listening to Point Taken. We are at the Annex Wealth Management Studio downtown Milwaukee. And this is my good friend, Todd Alba, who is joining me for today and tomorrow, co-hosting, filling in for Steve, who is on a very well-earned vacation, though he does get, I guess, are all of them well-earned?
I think so.
Maybe it's up for debate.
He's the hardest working man in radio, Kristen, if you ask him. No, he is.
No,
yeah, he has podcasts. You know, how many podcasts does Steve do?
He does Scafidiology.
Right.
He does The Outdoor Show, which is technically a podcast, but also airs on live on the weekends. We do You Need to Listen. He definitely stays busy. But yes, he is out for the week.
I'm just here as a chair warmer, Kristen. Nobody can replace Steve Scafidi. He can only just warm his chair until he gets back.
That's true. But this is your first time ever on W620 WTMJ?
Yeah, and I'm honored. I'm thrilled. First of all, because we've been friends for over 3 years now.
Yeah.
And I love hanging out with you. But today marks my 21st year in the start of my 21st year in broadcasting. Started at a little station, WRCO, back in Southwest Wisconsin, my hometown Richland Center. I was 17 in high school when I started.
Wow.
And my first job at RCO back in the day in high school was to come in on afternoons of spring training, and when Bob Uecker and Pat Hughes were calling the Brewers. And the flagship station was, still is, WTMJ. And so it was an affiliate station when Uecker would say, "You're listening to the Milwaukee Brewers radio network." We had pots, they're called dials. You had to pot down WTMJ so you didn't hear WTMJ. And you had to play your local commercials. So my first job at radio was to engineer a Brewers game for WTMJ. And here I am all these years later, honored to be on the station. Biggest stick in the state, as Steve says.
As they say, so 21 years in broadcasting. What are the different jobs you've done in broadcasting over two decades?
I started at RCO, Richland Center. Was there part-time on and off for 17 years while I did other things. I was doing it part-time. Went to UW Platteville to their now kind of defunct broadcast.
Oh, really?
Department. But back in the day, it was really good. I was the news director at our student radio station and had my own late night talk show, Sunday Night with Todd Albaugh. And then the coolest part, probably, we've talked about this before, I got to be the play-by-play announcer, or the color commentator, rather, with my great friend Kevin O'Connor, who's now at UWM here in town. Kevin and I called Platteville Pioneer basketball when Bo Ryan was coach there.
And we have that connection.
And we have that connection.
Bo Ryan being a very good family friend, since he was the assistant coach my dad's senior year playing for the Badgers.
And just got inducted into the Naismith Basketball
that
Hall
was
of Fame.
That's a very big deal.
Yeah, super big deal. And so, and then I kind of got out of it. I got out of it, got into politics. We might talk about that a little bit later. And then about 3 years ago, our former company, Civic Media, came calling. Had the opportunity to do a statewide radio show over there in Civic Media across the state for 3 years. And about 3 weeks ago, they, as many people do in media, they said, "Time's up." And me and five other folks got laid off, as they say. But that's media today.
But that's media, right?
Yeah.
That's like, that is part, that is something that I feel like I have a late start to this game as far as what media, it kind of, a lot of this, I don't want to say it fell in my lap, but as far as the opportunities that have made themselves available to me, but just hearing people's stories as far as, I mean, that happened just recently with, is it The Game? That
yeah.
just, you know.
Mike Keller. The incomparable Mike Keller, right?
Yeah, and so it is like such is life in media. But I am very happy that you're going to be here for the next 2 days, lightening my load while Steve is gone. But also just because you're a really fun person to talk to. I think there's one thing as far as the broadcasting side of it that goes, but as far as your, I feel like you represent, not unlike Steve. So people who listen to the show know that Steve still calls himself a Republican, still, I think, down ballot votes Republicans, but has, since day one, never been a Trump guy. Mm. So for you, you were a lifelong Republican and also decided even before Trump came on the scene that maybe the party was changing in ways that didn't fit your morals or your what you thought was integrity. So let's take a break. And when we come back, I want to hear a little bit more about your time in politics, working behind the scenes, both for in the state legislature and for Congress. So we will talk to Todd Alba and get to know him a little bit better. On the other side of this, you're listening to Point Taken. All right. Do you think you have the smarts? We'll join Vince Petrano, Greg Hill, Eric Bilstead, and Sandy Max for WTMJ's Trivia Showdown Wednesday, December 10th at 7 p.m. at Trattoria De Carlo and Pizzeria in Oak Creek. Presented by Quizmaster Trivia, benefiting Capco's Kids to Kids Toy Drive. Bring an unused toy or text toy to 855-616-1620 to donate. Bring your crew and play for a great cause. Todd Alba, are you good at trivia?
I'm okay. I'm okay.
What's your go-to? Like, what subjects are you usually like? I know I can...
Entertainment. I'm pretty good at
like
entertainment.
Pop culture?
Sometimes. Not too poppy. Like, I mean, like last 5 years, I'm not sure. But like 80s and 90s pop culture, okay. Sure.
When you were the target market of most
pop culture.
Yeah. And now you're like, who is this? Why is this person
My former boss, Dale Schultz, former state senator Dale Schultz, we were driving somewhere to an event sometime. I told him something pop culture-esque to use in a speech or to mention. And I'll clean it up for radio. But he looked at me and he goes, God, you know a lot of useless crap. But he goes, I'm sure glad you do.
All right. So that's a good segue. So we talked a little bit before about your broadcast experience, but I think your political experience is super interesting. Both, you know, often we know the names of the people who are actually elected officials, but for most of your career, you were the guy right behind the guy.
Yeah. I was the Barney Fife to other people's Andy Taylor, to use a Mayberry reference. I got involved. I was 12 years old in fifth grade, and I had a great fifth grade teacher, Otis Scott, who divided us up into you could choose a side, or he divided into sides. And yes, Kristen, we made bulletin boards.
Was this like
boards.
A civics class?
Yeah,
we made when they still taught
had
civics?
To make bulletin boards and collect stuff, put on the bulletin board. And so I went to the local county Republican booth at the fair and met this wonderful woman, Carol Clausius, and Ronald Reagan won that year, and Bob Caston for U.S. Senate and Steve Gunderson for the 3rd District in Wisconsin. I thought this is easy. And I kind of knocked on doors and did stuff like that.
You were 12?
Yeah.
So is that 7th grade?
5th grade.
No, you're not 12 in 5th grade.
Oh, no, I guess
like
it was
6th or 7th.
Yeah, something like that. I don't know. It was my fifth grade teacher.
Like a long time ago. All right, so it was a civics class that got you interested.
Yeah, interested, and I chose Republican Party because my granddad on my dad's side was a Reagan-esque type of Republican. And then a couple of years later, I guess that's when I was 12, met Dale Schultz, who was running for state assembly for the first time out in southwest Wisconsin, volunteered on his campaign. He won. And then eventually he just kept, volunteering. And in 1994, I took a semester off at UW-Platteville, and I went and ran Dale Schultz's reelection campaign to state Senate. By that time, he won a special race in the state Senate. It was to show you the difference. And Zepecki and McCashin could talk about this. In 1994, Dale Schultz was the number one target of the Democrats, and we raised and spent the most money to date in a state Senate campaign. Want to guess how much you did?
So it's 1994, yep. Most money to date on a state Senate campaign,
$20,000. $106,000.
Okay, so it wasn't that far off, but still.
But now it's $10-15 million for a state Senate campaign.
Salary is still like Jody Havers-Sinikin versus Dewey Strobel, I think, was crazy. An unbelievable amount this last time around. And so that's actually an interesting question. So you grew up in Richland Center, Richland County. In the 90s, because we know we talk a lot about how the state has shifted, especially the 3rd District. Was it more Democrat back then, or was it pretty purple still?
Some of the state legislature races were more Democratic leaning. But I think the big difference was that you weren't going to win an election out there. Steve Gunderson was not a raging right-wing Republican in today's terms. Remember, he was the guy who co-authored the Americans with Disabilities Act. He helped author legislation for Pell Grants for young mothers or dads to return back to school, continuing education. These are, by today's comparison, left-leaning proposals.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, it was Republican to reach out and help people who can't help themselves. Nothing wrong with that.
So you used to go work for Dale.
Yep.
How long did you work for Dale for?
He calls me the Billy Martin of the Schultz office. For those of you who might remember, the former manager of the Yankees who Steinbrenner fired and brought back and fired. I did five stints at the Schultz office, but was never fired.
Okay.
I left once to go work for Scott Klug in 1995.
Last Republican to represent Madison.
Yep. Moderate Republican, a pro-choice Republican, and also was one of the Republicans that voted for Clinton's 1994-1995 assault weapons ban. Klug was
different time.
Different time. So I worked for both of them on and off, and I ended up being the communication director for Dale when he was Senate Majority Leader from 2004 to 2007, and then came back. My final stint was as Chief of Staff in the State Capitol during Act 10 and the Scott Walker era.
What was that like?
Crazy. I went to work one day. I couldn't get into the building. I'm like, what the heck is going on? And I look up and there's Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton doing an impromptu press conference.
So looking back at that, like, do you have, because I feel like sometimes the memory of that, when you were still working and you were working for a Republican, did you feel like the people who were protesters were, I don't want to say the enemy feels like too strong of a word, but like, were they the villains in your story at that point?
No, because my boss was the only Republican that voted no on Act 10.
Oh.
He actually went out and listened to his constituents, and he said, we're not doing this. And so Dale was the only Republican in the Senate to vote against Act 10. But he was the last person to say who I was going to vote. And so that was part of the reason I left. I left the Republican Party long before Donald Trump. And to cut to the chase, it was over voter ID, so-called voter ID.
Well, and let's take a break, because I wanted to hear that story, because I think voter ID, I think, is something now we just assume that you have to have. And I was not living here. I wasn't even like an avid voter when all of this was happening in Wisconsin. And since you were in the room when the conversations were happening, I think that's really interesting to get into what the conversation was and what the purpose was and what changes were presented and what we've seen since then. So stay with us. I am Kristen Bry. He is Todd Alba, filling in for Steve today and tomorrow. And you're listening to Point Taken. Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry. Steve is out this week, but I have a very good friend, Todd Alba, filling in today and tomorrow. And we were taking this first half hour. Jazz is back today. She was gone yesterday. Getting a chance to know Todd a little bit better. And so take us, what was this, 2014?
2011.
It's 2011 when the voter ID laws changed?
Yeah.
Okay. So remind people what happened. So this was the first time Republicans had all three chambers. They had the state legislature and Scott Walker. Mm-hmm. And it was before or after Act 10?
It was right around the same time. So Walker runs. He never talks about Act 10 in his campaign for governor. Shocks a lot of people, even in the legislature. I was in the Senate Republican caucus, closed door, when Walker came in with his chief of staff and announced this. And there were senators like, what the hell? We didn't sign up for this. And voter ID came shortly thereafter, so in 2011.
So was there just no, you did not have to show an ID prior to 2011?
No, when you registered, you had to bring like a driver's license or a phone bill or utility bill or whatever. But then when you went into the polls, you just said, hey, especially in small towns, it's like, well, yeah, that's who you are.
Okay. Right?
And just for the record, not that my opinion really matters, but I'm not opposed personally to a voter, to having to show some form of ID.
Yeah.
I'm okay with that, right? What I have a problem with, and what my former boss, Dale Schultz, had a problem with, was when they started to manipulate these bills and said they were quote-unquote voter ID, but they were really voter suppression. In other words, not just that you didn't have to, so make it quick, was in the coffee business for a while after I left the legislature in 2015, had a young barista, Miguel Vega, born here, parents originally from Mexico, but was born in California, was working for me as a barista. These laws that I saw in closed caucus being written changed. Walker signed them in. Voter ID used to be, if you had a valid California driver's ID, you just took it into Wisconsin DMV. As long as it was valid, boom, switch it out. Due to the legislation, now you have to bring in your original birth certificate to do that, or a passport, or a military ID. Well, what 22-year-old knows where their birth certificate is, let alone somebody from California? So he wanted to vote for Bernie, first-time voter for Bernie Sanders, was denied that because his birth certificate was back in California. So I was in the, it, bring this back, in 2011, I was, as Hamilton, as the musical Hamilton says, big musical guy.
Same. You're
in
good company.
I was in the room where it happened, right? So they were debating this in closed caucus. Former State Senator Mary Lozick from this area of the state stands up. She was the chair of the Senate Committee on Elections. She said, hey, we need to start thinking about what this would mean for places like Milwaukee and college campuses. I.e. huge dog whistle for black, brown people and college kids will be less likely to vote.
Or, and she was a Republican?
She was Republican.
Okay.
And
but so, she was saying this is going to have, she was advocating saying this is going to have a negative impact on them.
No, she's saying we need to pass this because it will make it less likely that Democrats will vote in those areas.
So she just said the quiet part
out
loud.
She just said the quiet part out loud. And my boss was the only one who leaned forward and goes, I think we ought to think about what you just said here. And then State Senator Glenn Grothman, I heard you talk about, he is honest. And
he is honest.
He leans back in his chair and he says, well, Dale, we better do it while we still can, because you know if the Democrats have power, they do the same thing. And Dale looked at me and he goes, you stay here. He got up and walked out of the room and protested. And for 2 hours, I listened to people in my party, not everybody, mind you, not everybody, but many people giddy, people like Mary Lozick. Or giddy about this. Glenn Grothman, giddy about suppressing the vote of fellow citizens. And I said, I didn't sign up for this. And I went down to Dale's office and I said, I'm done. He goes, what do you mean you're done? I said, I can't do this. I explained. And by that time, we knew he wasn't going to run again.
Okay.
And he said,
so that
well,
was the end of for his career, too.
And he said, well, he said, will you stick around? I said, fine, I'm not going anymore. You know, Lincoln Day dinners. He goes, fine, you don't have to. And so I finished out my term with him, but, I left at that point.
So then after 2011, you hung it up?
Well, no, I stayed until the end of the term in
2015.
Yeah.
Oh, because he's a senator.
All right, because he is a state senator. But I mean, it was a bridge too far, and I think there's a lot of people in the state that feel like me that, look, play fair.
Yeah.
And the reason Republicans are doing this, Kristen, in my opinion, from being around and seeing these people behind closed doors, is that they're afraid of their – they know their ideas can't win, so they have to rig the game in order to win. And I think that's sad.
Interesting. All right. Well, we'll get more of that story over the next 2 days. Well, welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry. Steve is off this whole week. He will be back next Monday. My good friend Todd Elba is joining me today and tomorrow. Yesterday, I'm sure you saw, Todd, that Trump announced a $12 billion aid package for farmers amid the trade war. So the assistance is going to be paid through tariff revenue. So it's going to be $11 billion of one-time payments to farmers of crops included in the Agricultural Department's new Farmer Bridge Assistance Program. And then another billion is going to be for commodities not included in that program. So it's help for farmers. It's help for farmers that maybe wouldn't have been needed if there weren't tariffs in the first place. But it's obviously a very important voting block for Republicans being farmers, and also just important for, I would argue, for our economy, for our state, that farmers don't have even more obstacles put in front of them.
No, I mean, I grew up in Southwest Wisconsin. My paternal grandparents were dairy farmers for over 40 years. And so my heart is with ag producers. And I think most ag producers you talk to are like, just for the most part, get government out of my way and let me do my job. And to your point, I just find it interesting, in my opinion, that if the administration hadn't put these tariffs on across the world, we might not be where we need to have an aid bailout package.
Yeah, absolutely. So joining us now on the phone is a Wisconsin farmer, David Unbahan, who is a beef farmer, former dairy farmer in Richland County. Welcome to the show, David. Oh, can you hear us?
Yes.
Great. Just making sure that we have a good connection. So I guess from what you understand of the package that was announced yesterday, is this going to impact you or is this mostly going to help soybean farmers?
I read up a little bit on it. It's going to help everybody a little bit, but it wouldn't have been necessary if somebody hadn't blown up all the our trading partners with the tariffs. I mean, there's uncertainty, volatility in this market now that shouldn't have been.
So I guess since the beginning, I mean, I guess since Liberation Day, what is it, kind of paint a picture for us. What has it been like for you and in for the beef farmers in general?
Well, when he announced the Argentina beef buy, it threw a monkey wrench into the market. And, you know, let's crops drop, not crops, but beef prices dropped like 20 cents a hundred on, or $20 a hundred on animals in the futures market. So that has affected us. So we have not got we do not have contracts to protect us right now because of that.
David, this is Todd. I know when you came on our show in the past, you talked about that. Just talk for a minute, if you will, on why this whole thing, the beef problem, is here in the first place. It's kind of just secular within the market, correct?
Well, the beef market goes through a cycles all the time with the number of beef cows there are, and it's up and down. And we were in a high beef cycle because there was low number of beef cows, and but then bringing in the Argentina beef, you know, just even though it's not going to make a big effect on the high quality cuts of meat, it just throws variability into the market. And I mean, it's, you know, there's a lot of beef farmers are not happy with it. I mean, beef groups that are traditionally Republican have been out against this too. So
what is what has the conversation been like with other farmers when you're talking about this? Like, what is a better fix? Whether it's, I mean, obviously what's done is done, but is this the best solution right now to at least make you whole as far as this aid package?
This isn't going to make you whole. I mean, this is a ploy to gather votes, in my opinion. I mean, they'd have been better off supporting USAID than giving this money to the farmers. I mean, there's a lot of farm products that went into that USAID program, and those dried up. And, you know, you're talking a lot of products in that mix.
I think that's a great point. We're talking to David Umbihan, a beef farmer from Richland County. David, explain, for those that might not know, U.S. Agency for International Development, administered through the State Department, brought a lot of food, saved lives in other countries, but helped American ag producers as well.
Oh, yeah. And it also, I mean, a country that feeds you, their people are going to be much more receptive to other things in the political realm. And I think that's been blown out of the water completely. We've got a bunch of relationships that I don't know if they're going to be able to be repaired.
With different countries?
With different countries.
Interesting. You know, David, we've had Brian Reisinger as a friend of the show, author of Land Rich, Cash Poor, and he talks a lot about fixing our food supply systems. And so to you as a beef farmer in Wisconsin, do you feel like there's solutions there as far as like supporting local markets, supporting your local farmers? Is there, or what do you see as some of the bigger solutions that could be done with some kind of expediency?
Well, as far as places that people can market their beef, you have the big ones. You have Tyson, just the big five. And they've got way too much control on the beef market. And it's not going to be fixed with local markets, but the monopoly that the big five have is difficult for smaller operations to navigate. To get prices.
And so what do you see a solution being?
Well, maybe some rules on, you know, maybe transparency in the beef market from the big companies. You know, they're huge. and
so potentially stronger antitrust laws when it comes to our food.
I would guess that would be a start.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for your time today, David.
Well, thank you so much.
Absolutely. David Unbahan is a beef farmer, former dairy farmer in Richland County. We'll take another break, and Todd Alba will still be here with me, Kristen Bry, on Point Taken. Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry, talking with Todd Alba, my co-host for today and tomorrow. And we were just talking to a beef farmer, David Unbahan, who's over in Richland County. And so when you, I mean, you've talked to a lot, you grew up in Richland County, you've talked to a lot of farmers over the years. Like I said, we've had Brian Reisinger on the show, Pam Yonke's come on the show a lot. But as far as what is your interpretation of the rock and the hard place that farmers are in right now?
As someone who had David on our show a couple of times before, and I've known his family for quite a few years, I heard frustration and just exasperation, maybe a little bit in his voice. And I think that represents a lot of farmers across Wisconsin, ag producers. My granddad and grandma would dairy farm for 40 plus years out there in Richland County. They were kind of like, just keep government out of my life. Let me do my thing and let the markets do their thing. And I know we had a texter basically getting to the point, why have Republicans traditionally supported or
traditionally supported Republicans.
Thank you for interpreting my my bad talking. Maybe that's why I was let go. But I think that the short answer is, speaking for one guy, is that traditionally Republicans were more of, we're not going to put a bunch of excessive environmental laws on you. We're going to kind of let you do your thing. And that was appealing. Now, there are Democratic, more Democratic-leaning organizations in Wisconsin, Farmers Union and things like that. So not like Democrats have never had a foothold in agriculture in this state. But I think you're hearing now from farmers.
I mean, I think a lot of farmers love Tammy Baldwin.
100%.
Right.
Because she goes out and listens to them and can have a, finishes her beer when she goes north of Wisconsin to a, she does, to a little dive bar. Anyway, I think what you're hearing from ag producers is this exasperation. David pointed this out, is that this, there is no easy fix. You had a great question, but there is no easy answer to your great question, Kristen, because there is no easy fix. It's going to take years, if not generations, to reestablish these relationships with these other countries in agricultural trade that the Trump administration has put into place. And so you're sitting there going, how the hell do I get out of this? And it's really tough, and we're up against the clock, but David's done a lot of great work with suicide prevention, ag community. You've talked to Reisinger about this. The number of death by suicide in the Wisconsin ag community, skyrocketing.
Yeah.
And part, I'm not saying, oh, it's caused directly by Trump, but this added stress, it ain't helping.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it was interesting to say the antitrust laws and the monopolies of the Big Five, which isn't a monopoly, but, you know, the control over the market that a small amount of companies have, which is similar to what we're talking about the next hour, talking about entertainment and this fight that's happening between Paramount and Netflix and Warner Brothers and Hostile Takeover to consolidate even more of our entertainment and what that does to us. So that's coming up in the next hour. He is Todd Alba. I am Kristen Bry. We'll take another break and be back after this. You know, I am interested. So we had someone text in, said, is there going to be a counterpoint to this conversation? Or are we just going to talk about from one side? And like, that's a great point. Like, I would love to know, from a farmer's perspective, who are pleased with what's happened so far. Like, and I think there is people who probably are farmers who still support Trump, but would also admit that this year has been hard. But it would be interesting to find someone who has that, as far as like arguing that this has been the best moves so far this year under this administration for our farmers.
We brought Pam Yonke up, the fabulous farm babe.
She was busy today. We invited her to come on the show to talk through this.
I know you guys have talked to her. I have talked to her on our former show. And she's as straight down the middle as you'll ever find, in my opinion, in terms of politically. I mean, she's
straight down the line. She's also very diplomatic. Like, yeah, you can tell she works in communications, as far as she'll tell it like it is, but she also picks her words thoughtfully.
I think that's very true. And I'm not trying to put words in her mouth, but I'm just saying, if you follow Midwest Farm Report, I haven't seen a lot of happy news saying, oh, this is great, these tariffs out there. And when you talk to actual producers, you're most more so than I on socials. Yes, you can find the outlier, in my opinion, of a MAGA farmer who there was literally something on socials a couple days ago where the guy lost his farm and still said he was going to vote, continue to vote MAGA, which blows my mind. But yeah, I'd be happy to hear the quote unquote other side to this. I follow a lot of beef people on socials that are traditionally Republican, pro-Trump MAGA, and they were speaking out against the influx of foreign beef, and they certainly weren't in support of these huge tariffs against China that stopped soybean buying over there. And so, sure, if there's another side out there, we'd love to hear from a legitimate ag producer on it. But I think this is one where even if you're a supporter of President Trump, this one's baffling.
Well, it's also we're coming up against the clock. But I do think it's also something psychologically that's interesting, like you said, as far as the pride in doing the work that you're doing and not wanting to hand out. Right. And the frustration of, yes, this package makes us whole or makes it alleviate some of the pain from it. But as far as getting to do the work, getting to sell your product rather than having a Band-Aid over it, even just psychologically, how that feels and how that translates. I wonder how, because I would think that, like, there's a lot of pride in the farming community.
Yeah, and David Umbihan's family is traditionally, for a long time, voted Republican. He's not some big lefty, let me tell you that, right? And I think you hit it, Kristen, that there is a feeling of disappointment and betrayal by the ag community. They're like, we put up those MAGA signs. We put up the Trump signs, those 4x8 farm signs, and now this is what we get?
Yeah. Well, it's all, yeah. All right, let's take a break. There's a lot more to dig into here. We are going to talk about the Netflix Warner Brothers hostile takeover coming up. We also have Celestin Morgan coming up in the next hour to talk about consolidation in schools as we have less kids going to different schools across the state. So stay with us. He is Todd Alba. I am Kristen Bry. Steve is off this week, and this is Point Taken.
Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here's Kristen Bry. And in for Steve Scafidi, here's Todd Albaugh.
Oh, so we're no longer at State Fair. Thanks, Jazz. We moved back. I wonder how cold that studio is right now at State Fair. Or have they moved? There's probably heating. I'm only ever there in the summer, so I have no idea. All right. Yes, indeed. Todd Alba, my good friend, is sitting in with me today and tomorrow, talking about a wide variety of topics, as we typically do. And so yesterday, well, one, I find this ironic because, so the Golden Globes, did you follow the Golden Globes at all this the announcements yesterday?
I was traveling, and so I didn't see the announcement, sorry.
Are you someone who tries to see all the award-nominated films?
I am kind of an awards kind of guy.
Okay. So, Netflix and HBO got the most nods for TV, which is, you know, not unusual.
No surprise.
But it feels significant since they may come together in a merger. But the word may is the operative word there being may. Because I had asked this to Dave Spano yesterday in our weekly segment with the CEO of Annex Wealth Management. Because I had not realized that yesterday, I think while we were on air, at least I didn't see it until after I was off air, that Paramount Skydance has now made... They're in hostile territory as far as trying to take Warner Brothers. And so I don't know how this ends up, but either way, so basically, as far as what I understand, so Paramount's offer is $30 per share in cash and could reportedly go even higher. Whereas Netflix made its deal at $27.75 per share in cash and stock, but Netflix only wants Warner Brothers and Discovery's streaming and studio business, where Paramount wants all of it, meaning CNN, CBS, like all of the other cable elements of it. I have no idea where the Warner Brothers Discovery shareholders stand, as far as I would imagine that they want more money if possible. But all of this goes through Washington. And the remarks I had heard from Trump that were reported on yesterday was him saying that he didn't necessarily see a Netflix deal going through. And silly me, I thought it was because it would be too big of a deal and this much consolidation in our entertainment is maybe not a good thing. Well, now you can start to pull away and knowing that Paramount Skydance is also in the equation, where the Ellison family is a very big ally to the Trump administration, that this could favor Skydance Paramount simply because of the political relationships there. And if you look at the market, which is sometimes a good indicator, Netflix shares dropped more than 3% yesterday. Well, Paramount shot up to 9%. So who do you think's betting on which company ends up on top?
Quick story. I promise it'll come back around. Back at UW Platteville, where we went to college, had a professor, Jack O'Neill. Great guy. Used to come in with a well-worn leather satchel. He'd flop it up on the desk, whatever classroom we're in, either grab a piece of chalk or a dry erase marker, go to the board, write a big old dollar sign. And he'd turn around and he'd say, it all comes down to that. What's new in your world of broadcast communications? We thought, what the hell is he talking? Now I know. It doesn't matter what we were talking about last hour with politics and trade deals, or whether it comes down to entertainment and media, which you and I are both in, all comes down to the dollar sign. And I think in many ways, politics and media are now crossing more than ever, and I don't think in a good way, in my opinion, to your point, where you've got Trump now at the Kennedy Awards Center honors, which he, by the way, hosted, which I thought was weird. Jimmy Kimmel got a year-long extension yesterday. Did you see that?
I did see that.
Yeah. Because he attacked Kimmel. But now
his speech he did?
No, he would say it beforehand, well, if I can't do as good as Jimmy Kimmel, I shouldn't be president of the United States.
Oh.
Yeah. But to this issue, Trump now on the red carpet saying, well, you know, I'm going to have to take a look at this deal with Netflix and Time Warner or Warner Discovery now. And is this what we want? Do we want the president of the United States stepping in here to your – and part of this links back, of course, to ABC and CBS. I know you and Steve have talked about this before, having these multi-million dollar payouts for Trump lawsuits that were, pun intended, trumped up. And is this just another way for Trump – because the Paramount-Skydance merger only went through after CBS, Paramount, agreed to pay Trump whatever $16 million for that 60 Minutes interview with Kamala Harris last year, which, by the way, nothing wrong with it, in my opinion. But it just feels dirty, Kristen.
Well, this was also, so this was David Ellison on CNBC. Was this yesterday that he was on talking about what it would
day before.
Before, as far as Paramount being in the news business.
A couple of real quick things before we wrap up. I mean, CNN, I assume you would combine the news gathering operation with CBS's if, in fact, you did own that asset?
Yeah, so look, we've been really clear since probably last time we're here what we want to do with news.
Yes.
Which is we want to build a scaled news service that is basically fundamentally in the trust business, that is in the truth business, and that speaks to the 70% of Americans that are in the middle. And we believe that by doing so, that is, for us, kind of doing well while doing good. And we believe in that business model, and we believe it's essential.
And do you think the president embraces the idea of you being the owner of CNN, given his criticism, obviously, for that network in the past?
By the way, we've had great conversations with the president about this, but I think I don't want to speak for him in any way, shape, or form.
What's up with that? I mean, saying that I have to acquiesce to Donald Trump. I don't care whether it's Donald Trump or Joe Biden, who it is.
Because what do you think the better answer to that question would have been? It doesn't matter what Trump's feelings about this deal.
In the past, you're right. It would have been, who cares? This is about business. The president of the United States. And this would, as a former Republican, Kristen, by the way, I don't belong to any Republican or any party now. I'm independent. But what ticks me off, what I find fascinating, that's the better word, is that my former party, who has always been, hey, get the government out of business, let business and the markets take. Both Scott Walker, when he was governor of the state of Wisconsin, interfered more in local control than any governor I've ever seen. Talk about issues like fracking and high capacity wells, usurped the power of local governments. Now you got President Trump going into business, interfering. This is not the traditional, Steve talks about this. This is not traditional Republican conservatism. This is Trumpism. Call it for what it is.
Let's take a break really quickly, because I also think having the news cycle, because on its face of what David Ellison said there, as far as appealing to the 70%, being in the trusted, being in the business of building trust, like that sounds good. But I ultimately, like you said, with that big dollar sign, how do you ever actually trust a corporation who is beholden to their shareholders to be the ones who are delivering you your news?
And this industry is moving faster than anybody ever thought. Just ask me.
Exactly. All right. We'll be back with more after this on Point Taken. All right. Do you think you're good at trivia? Join Vince Vitrano, Greg Hill, Eric Bilstead, and Sandy Max for WTMJ's Trivia Showdown Wednesday, December 10th. That's tomorrow at 7 p.m. at Trattoria De Carlo in Pizzeria in Oak Creek, presented by Quizmaster Trivia, benefiting Capco's Kids to Kids Toy Drive. Bring an unused toy or text TOY to 855-616-1620 to donate. Bring your crew and play for a great cause. All right, trivia question of the day. Literally, this is from Google. When you just type in trivia of the day, right, this is the first question that popped up. Todd Elba, how many bones comprise a giraffe's neck?
Thanks. I did go to vet school. I bet it's fewer than you think, maybe. I'll say 250.
Seven.
So technically, you're right.
It's the same. 250 bones in their neck?
I don't know. It's a big neck. I don't know.
It's the same number of bones as a human being's neck, except that the giraffes, their cervical vertebrae are like massive.
Okay.
So.
Thanks for making me expose the fool I am on the air on the biggest station of the state.
I guess you didn't say zoology as one of the topics right. That you would be good at when you earlier said that.
No.
You were
science
decent at trivia.
Math, not my forte.
That's hilarious. All right. Coming back to our conversation around this Netflix, Warner Brothers Discovery, Paramount love triangle that I don't know how long. I mean, this is my thing. So if you're going to block a Netflix Warner Brothers deal, because of, you know, if the FTC is going to do that because it's saying it's too big and you can't consolidate like that, how do you argue that the Paramount deal is fine?
You can't. I mean, I think it really is going to come down to these politics, who Trump wants, what he gets out of it, and what message is out there. And here's, I think, for the fans out there, why is this important to me? Why are these guys talking about this? Here's why, in my opinion. Barry Weiss, a lot of people might not know that name. She is now the editor-in-chief of CBS News, was formerly at the Free Press, which she started, was a right-leaning publication. She just hired a guy, Matt Gutman, from ABC, because both Marie Dubois and John Dickerson, the CBS Evening News anchors, announced they're out of here in a couple of weeks. They're gone after less than a year. And the lens, Connie Chung, former anchor with Dan Rather at CBS.
Her and Maury just did a whole interview. Who was interviewing them?
I forget. Some podcast, I guess. Okay. But, and you and Steve talked about this. Look, I grew up in an era where we sat down and watched Walter Cronkite or Dan Rather or Peter Jennings. Evening News was still a thing. And for some people, it still is. But who controls the news that we listen to and watch matters. Because you just want the truth at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. That's what we did with our show. I think that you and Steve do with this show. And it's why places like 620 WTMJ matter, is because you want somebody who's just going to give you the facts. And sure, you can have opinion programs here and there.
Which is what this is, yeah.
But you want a news element to that that's going to be true to that. And in my opinion, you're not getting that with these major news outlets that are changing all the time. Media at the highest level can't figure out what's happening because it's moving so fast into streaming and into social media, and people are getting more information on this on their cell phone than they are on their televisions. And so how we get that news matters, and it frames how we vote when we go to the polls, the information we have in our brains. Because let's face it. Come on, Chris. People like you and I are few and far between. We're kind of political news junkies.
Mm-hmm.
And as I traveled around the state the last 3 years of my former job, I'd ask people, where do you get your news information? I want to know. Number one answer, I don't.
Interesting.
I can't handle it. It's too overwhelming. I don't know what to believe. I feel like, what can I do with that?
What was the average age of the people you were asking?
I asked everybody from people in their early 20s through 80. And so, I mean, I'm 56, so I guess I'm the median of that maybe. But it didn't matter. Didn't matter who. I would say, you know, people – and I was surprised. People your age-ish, millennials, TikTok, way up there.
Yeah.
Where they get their
news.
But
again, that's a platform. That's not a news source. This is what annoys me. Twitter's the largest news platform in existence. It's like, yeah, but that's the platform. This is the reason why they can't be held accountable for misinformation that gets spread on the platform, because they are not the company that is providing news. They are creating a platform for people with a very low barrier to entry to give the news, talk about the news, give commentary about the news, so that you can get your news from that platform. But they are not the people where there is like an editorial review or any kind of fact checking anymore. That this is why I think people's trust is so broken, because you don't trust necessarily the major outlets that have, you know, a fiduciary duty to shareholders. You don't necessarily, people don't trust the Washington Post anymore because Jeff Bezos is in charge of it. Like, it's just, where do you go? And if the answer is just, I don't.
Check it out. And to your point that you were talking about on this program yesterday, how people vote, they're seeking, they want to vote for somebody who's really independent, who's just going to do their job and represent the people. And I think it's the same way people want to get news information, but do it the right way that's not overwhelming left or right.
But how do you make money doing that?
Bingo.
All right. We'll take another break. We'll be back in a minute. This is Todd Alba. Well, that's Todd Alba. I'm Kristen Bry, and this is Point Taken. I'm having a little bit of an out-of-body experience at this moment, because on our this morning before the show started, I went over to WISN, the news, the TV channel, not the radio station, because this Friday, I, along with the mayor, are hosting the Milwaukee Holiday Gala, which is being put on by my husband's company, Swarm Events. You can check it out at mkeholidaygala.org. And Jaron Jordan over at WISN Channel 12 asked me to come on and talk about the event, how it's all 100% of proceeds are going to Camp Rise and Toys for Tots. And literally it just aired at the for the 11 o'clock news. And so I look up at the TV, and there I am in my purple dress earlier this morning.
How good is Kristen Bry? She could be two places at once. That's how good she is.
That is the voice of Todd Alba. And you got a chance this morning to meet the morning news guys, Eric and Vince. And all this week, Wisconsin Morning News is unveiling its WTMJ 2025 Standouts of the Year. These are people who have left an impact in the state these last 12 months. And today's Standout of the Year is MPS Superintendent Dr. Brenda Casilius.
I motion to name Dr. Brenda Casilius as the lone finalist for the Milwaukee Public School Superintendent position.
On a chilly February night, after an eight-month search, the Milwaukee Board of School Directors named Dr. Brenda Casilius its choice for superintendent.
I've been looking at Milwaukee for quite a while. They have a student population that matches the purpose of what I believe is my life work.
A busy day three on the job for Dr. Brenda Casilius.
When you applied for this position, did you think you were going to start March 15th and have the boots on the ground already?
I did not.
Casilius came to a district in peril. The last superintendent resigned due to inaccurate and missing financial reports. District scores were low. By court order, SROs were just returning to schools, and oh, by the way, there's a lead problem in some of the buildings.
We are doing everything we can. We probably are using up every paint contractor who is lead certified in the community and across the state, and calling on getting more for the summer to get this work done.
She came in and she wasn't afraid to say, hey, we have been making mistakes and now it's time to clean that up.
101.7 The Truth's Kyle Wallace. Among the changes, major overhauls to the central office, eliminating positions and sending more staff into the school building.
A lot of people who know MPS knows MPS used to have a lot of, I would say, fat inside a central office. And she told folks, listen, we are educators, and first and foremost, we need to be in the classrooms. And so people got sent back to the classroom, have been in central office, having pretty good jobs. So major player was shaking things up.
Casilius hired a consultant to help with the financial reporting. She enhanced the quality of the food being served. She targeted student attendance and truancy and has begun the process of merging low enrollment schools. The biggest challenge ahead? Ensuring students are the top priority.
It's not about who you may go back inside the classroom. It's not about, you know, turning in paperwork on time. It's about getting the results from the students. Until we see these test scores for these students in Milwaukee public schools go up, then we're still going to be questioning whether or not she is the right person. So she needs to make sure that these students are achieving reading, writing, arithmetic, and all that. That's what matters the most.
A challenge Casilius isn't shying away from.
We have children centered in every decision that we make.
I think there's a really great promise here, and we're really excited.
You can listen to Wisconsin Morning News tomorrow at 7:20 for the latest WTMJ Standout of the Year. You can always get more information online at WTMJ.com or by texting STANDOUT to the WTMJ Siding Unlimited talk and text line 855-616-1620. After the news, we will continue the conversation around Milwaukee schools with Celestin Morgan. This is Point Taken.
It's time for some forward thinking on Point Taken. Brought to you by City Forward Collective, focusing on education in Milwaukee.
All right, indeed, we are returning champion of education politics and all the things in between. Celestin Morgan, president and executive director of City Forward Collective, is here in studio. When was the last time you were here? Two weeks ago?
It was right before Thanksgiving, but it's always good to be back. I'm glad you guys keep bringing us back.
We do keep bringing you back. Certainly lots to talk about, as always. We just had Wisconsin Mornings News Standout of the Year. One of their Standout of the Year was Brenda Casilius, and so we just played that.
Great.
As far as the moves she has been making so far in her tenure. But one of the things we wanted to talk to you about today, which she has actually been on record considering talking about the opportunity of, is right sizing.
Yes.
So what is right sizing?
So, you know, we have a smaller city now and fewer kids than we had a few years ago. It's about 15% since, you know, 2006 is when the numbers start from. And that means fewer kids.
Put that in context. What is fewer numbers?
Fewer numbers. So we were at peak probably about 120,000 students or so across the board. This year, it's about 108,000.
And
so,
is this just for MPS or this is private schools, charter, MPS?
This is everybody across the board. I would say those declines have been concentrated at MPS, but we are seeing, you know, we're having fewer kids as a society. We're, you know, family sizes are getting smaller. Frankly, there are some challenges that we had here, specifically in Milwaukee. We had a teen pregnancy crisis for a number of years. We've done good work on resolving that. All this means, you know, fewer kids that are entering school in any given year. And so the conversation that Dr. Casillas is having on the MPS side, and that we think, frankly, has to be a citywide conversation, is how do we have the right number of schools for the number of students that we have right now and that we're likely to have in the future? Because everything, all the leading indicators, I think John Johnson at Marquette Law School did sort of the best piece on this a year and a half ago. You know, that 15% decline that we've seen up till now, if anything, is going to get a little bit larger over the next few years. They are projecting 20% fewer kindergartners 5 years from now than we have in school today. So add it all up, and that's maybe 1,000 fewer kindergartners entering school 5 years from now than maybe we had 5 years ago. And it just means we need fewer seats. And that works its way through the system as kids get older.
So that, to me, on its face, without knowing, it feels a little counterintuitive, because I think so often when we think about problems with schools is overcrowded classrooms. So is that not an issue for MPS, or is that not an issue for Milwaukee schools, is overcrowded classrooms?
Both can happen at the same time.
Okay.
And so I would say, like, here in Milwaukee, the story on the north side is very different than the story on the south side. And actually, I think MPS's own data pairs this out pretty well. They are going through their facilities planning process, and they laid this out. In one of the south side school districts, I think they're at 104% of capacity, meaning, you know, they've got more students being educated in that, you know, in that district than the seats they have available. And then in another district, they have, I think it's 65 or 70%. So there is a mismatch between where the seats are at and where the kids are at. And that's part of what's going on here. So you certainly do have individual schools that have more students in them than maybe they were built to serve. But that also is balanced by, you know, other school buildings elsewhere in the city where, you know, we've got high schools that were built for maybe 2,000, 3,000 students that might be serving 200 to 300 students.
Oh, wow.
So, right, take it all together. Okay. We got too many seats, even still, even if that means that at an individual campus, you might have too much. And some of that's got to do with school quality, too, right? Families are still trying to find those highest performing schools, the ones that best fit their kids. Our Montessori schools here in Milwaukee are always in demand. Some of our, you know, private and charter schools are particularly high demand. They tend to fill up, even as other schools maybe are emptier before. So, right, like, this is an optimization challenge. It's not just a simple everybody's, you know, it's not uniform across every school in the city, which is what makes this a really complex conversation.
A couple of quick things. My former job in the legislature was down here at MPS with my former boss, Dale Schultz. Was super impressed with a lot of things, both public and private schools, happening in Milwaukee. Our former show, we did it at Milwaukee South High School. Some great things happening there. I come from a more rural part of the state, and when you start talking about consolidation, it scares the bejeebers out of people, because it's like, this is my identity. So help us understand fear versus facts.
Yeah, it's a great question, right? Like, and this is a conversation that the state is having, right? In fact, I think this were a package of bills that were discussed in the legislature just a couple weeks ago. And I get it. It is scary. But the trend lines, I've given you the Milwaukee numbers. The state numbers are similar, maybe not quite as large scale. But if that school is the, you know, heart of your community, be that a, you know, a neighborhood in Milwaukee or a rural town, these are real tricky conversations that require us wrestling with, you know, what is the value of a school? What does it mean to a community? You know, we're having these same conversations in higher education, too, where we've seen a lot of consolidation in the UW system. You know, there's only so much that we can do to work ourselves away from the realities of, you know, we've got fewer people that are going to school. And so we got to reconcile ourselves to that. And that probably means fewer schools. But we got to do that in a way, you know, I've said in other places before, we've got to all share in that pain. And we've also got to spend more time talking about the gain, right? Because part of the opportunity here is when we do that right sizing in smart ways, it allows for more resources to be unlocked for the kids in the schools that are in place, right? You've got schools in rural parts of the state that used to field football teams that aren't able to do that anymore as a, you know, real concrete example, right? If you bring two high school communities together, we here in Milwaukee, you've got a lot of co-op teams that play different sports, you know, that's an opportunity, or maybe that preserves some sports opportunities or allows you to have more arts in that school building, or just frankly, the number of teachers that you need to serve. Like, this is, all of this matters, and it's not a simple, you know, they're down by 30%, so cut 30, you know, schools or whatever the case may be.
When you right size, have you found you could also maintain some of that identity for each community or each school?
Absolutely, right? You know, it requires some thoughtful merging and bringing together of these communities, right? Like, these are conversations that happen over periods of time, months and years, right? The conversation at the state level has been about how do we provide some, you know, study support and understand what are the particulars that need to happen when you're merging two tax bases in a rural community. Here in Milwaukee, most of this is happening inside of one school district, so we don't have that conversation, but we still have real conversations about what does it mean, you know, many of our most under-enrolled schools are on the north side of the city in historically black neighborhoods that have struggled with disinvestment. How do we do this in a way that recognizes that reality, but also recognizes that there's a bit of a chicken and the egg issue here in terms of that disinvestment that's happened over generations? So it can't be the case that one part of the city or one set of schools or even one sector here in the city bears the full brunt of this. You know, everyone's got to play their part to get us to the number of students and the right levels of investment that we need to ensure that every kid's got a school that they can thrive in.
Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to hear more about who would be in the room as far as these conversations happening. Is it just local community by community? Is it a statewide thing? And what does right sizing actually look like when it is done well? So Todd Alba is my guest host today. Celestin Morgan is our guest for this section, segment, whatever. Stay with us. It's Point Taken. Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry. Todd Alba is joining me today as my co-host, and we'll be back tomorrow as well because Steve is out. And this is our segment, Forward Thinking, with Celestin Morgan from City Forward Collective. And we are talking about right-sizing, which sounds logical on paper, but in practice, I would imagine, is very messy, has a lot of stakeholders. And who do you actually bring in the room? Who's important to be in the room if this conversation moves forward?
You know, I think who's in the room matters, but let me actually start with people who aren't in the room but are impacted by this, right? We've got to talk to parents and to families and to students and to communities. You know, oftentimes these decisions sort of happen in, you know, someone in the central office or some people in a political space, you know, sit in a room and put together a plan on paper, but they've never actually engaged with the communities that are being impacted by these decisions. You know, I've said we're not the only city dealing with this. One of the better pictures I've seen all year was a picture of the mayor of Cleveland sitting in a chair at a barbershop, having a like barbershop talk with a number of leaders in Cleveland, because they're going through this conversation as well. They're in the midst of considering, I think it's 37 school closures and consolidations there based on many of the same factors we're seeing here. That's what it takes, right? These conversations have to, you know, yes, you know, there's some data and information that can inform them, but ultimately you've got to go out and sell this. You've got to go out and have the conversations in and with the community. And we shared some polling, Kristen, maybe two or three times ago when I was here. Milwaukee's ready for this conversation as a city. We found 58-60% of people, you know, in general supported the idea of consolidations. And when you gave them, you know, even just a little bit of information in the poll, that number actually went up. But it requires those hard conversations, those difficult conversations to be had. And that's where I would say, you know, it sounds like Dr. Casillas may have been in here earlier, having those conversations. Certainly as she's been out and about more generally, she's acknowledged this as a reality that we're facing here in the city. And I think that's a good and healthy dialogue for us to start.
I'll give you the opportunity to address people that might be out there listening, fans, say, well, why not just fix the public school? Why all this, you know, downsizing, right sizing, consolidation, whatever you want to call it? Is this a sign that we're ignoring the issues in the public schools? Or is this, as you alluded to earlier, people are not having as many kids anymore and the facilities are too big? It's a necessity.
Look, let's speak to Milwaukee specifically and Milwaukee Public School specifically, right? You know, we, you know, as a community have now passed two increases in funding totaling about $350 million, right, just since 2020. Even with those additional resources, the district has still said they're looking at somewhere on the order of $100 million in terms of a, you know, structural gap to resolve.
And that's structural. So that means the buildings,
yeah,
right?
Right. You know, that means the buildings, right? We
and they're,
you know,
old buildings.
They
lot
were
of them.
Just talking, was it last week, about finishing the lead paint remediation work, right? And that's just sort of like, that was sort of an emergency patch job that needed to happen. But, you know, when you look at sort of like the full measure of what it would take to bring these buildings up to snuff, like that, those dollar numbers get really big really quickly. Outside of the reach, you know, I'm not certain that there is a tax increase or funding increase, state or local, in sight that could do that. You know, there are legitimate conversations and disagreements to be had about how much of that should come from local property taxes. You would hear, you know, people at the state tell you that, you know, they've finally gotten back to the 2/3 state support that's existed for a long time. You'd hear others say, but, you know, special education isn't funded where it needs to be. Frankly, there's a lot of truth on both sides of that conversation. And the reality is, even after we get through all of that, we're still going to confront the reality of 15% fewer students now than we had before, probably another 15 to 20% to come over the next 5 to 10 years if the projections and early demographic leading indicators hold. So the answer is some of both. Yes, you know, I certainly believe we need to make sure that all of our kids have the resources that they need. But part of that is making sure that the resources that we have are actually making it to the classrooms where they're being served and not being diverted to keep up, you know, buildings that have 110, 120 kids in them in some cases.
And there's real trade-offs, too.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, whether or not you're going to do, you know, transportation issues. I mean, I don't want to say winners or losers. That sounds kind of bad.
No, but there's certainly pros and cons. Yeah,
but I think that's a better way to put it. That's why you're the host of this show, Kristen.
Especially when I can get words out of my mouth.
But there are trade-offs.
There absolutely are trade-offs. There absolutely are pros and cons. It requires a conversation that gets out of, you know, frankly, demagoguing it on either side, right? Like, this is not about, you know, blaming one side, blaming the other. This is not about, you know, political talking points. This is about just the hard number of realities. You know, what do we need to make sure that our kids are in schools that are safe, that are warm, that are effective in educating them, and that they're getting access to the resources and opportunities that they deserve? And, you know, that's going to require all of us to have some, you know, make some difficult choices. But we've got to be able to do that and have that dialogue with parents, with students, with the communities that are being impacted, not have it about them in other enclosed doors.
So just final, is this happening or is this still the conversation about it potentially happening?
And, you know, it's a good question, right? Like I said, you know, you've heard Milwaukee Public Schools talk about this. You're seeing the legislature open this conversation. I worry that we're not moving quickly enough, right? Mm-hmm. We are now into our second or third decade of declines in terms of enrollment here in Milwaukee. I think we're into our second decade of it at the state level as well. None of these trends are changing anytime soon. There's no reason to believe that, you know, the cavalry is coming and somehow we're not going to have them. So my hope is that as we go forward, we can have them from a place of here are the facts and here are the data and here's how we make the best decisions we can, putting our students at first and at the center of these conversations. My fear is that we're going to get stuck in some of the political morass and impasse.
No, what? Of course not. All right. He is Gillespie Morgan, president and executive director of City Forward Collective. We will see you in a couple weeks. Thanks as always for being here.
Of course. And happy holidays to you both.
As well as you. All right. We'll come back and finish up the show after this. All right. We got to get out of here. But Todd, I think you did a pretty good job today. I think we'll bring you back tomorrow. Yeah. And so Todd Alba, thank you for coming here today.
Thank you.
He'll be back tomorrow. And what else do we have tomorrow? We'll have Ask Us Anything so people can ask you questions.
Oh.
Reed Galen, I think, is joining to have a conversation about independent voters and a conversation around why the energy bills keep going up. So come back tomorrow. News is next.